Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The Secretary General of the UN, Antonio Guterres, has arrived in Iraq for the first time in 6 years. This is a visit of solidarity with Iraqi people and the country's democratic structures, Mr. Guterres said in Baghdad on Wednesday, shortly after touching down. The official UN visit comes as Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani attempts to revive the country's fortunes after decades of conflict and infighting. Mr. al-Sudani, a Shia politician, was elected Prime Minister by the Iraqi Parliament last October after a year of political impasse over the formation of the country's government. The President of Iraq is Abdul Latif Rashid, an independent Kurdish politician. While the United Nations remains totally committed to supporting Iraq's institutions, the Secretary-General expressed his belief that Iraqis will be able to overcome the challenges they still face through an open and inclusive dialogue. Children all over the world are increasingly at risk from a lack of critical social protection, leaving them vulnerable to underage marriage, illegal labor practices, and other life-changing hardship, UN agencies UNICEF and ILO said on Wednesday. The warning from the UN Children's Fund and the International Labour Organization outlines the devastating impacts on youngsters' health, education and nutrition when welfare safety nets are not in place. The agency cited new data showing that between 2016 and 2020, an additional 50 million children missed out on child benefits, driving up the total number to 1.46 billion globally. Factors that have contributed to growing insecurity for children in recent years include the COVID-19 emergency, the global cost of living crisis, conflict, displacement, and climate change. And according to the joint ILO and UNICEF report, every region in the world saw child and family benefits fall or stagnate between 2016 and 2020. This has created the very real risk that no country is on track to achieve the Sustainable Development Goal of achieving substantial social protection coverage by 2030, the UN agency said. Staying with development, UN Rights Chief Volker Türk has appealed to all countries to support sustainable development as a way out of the world's current destructive spiral. Marking the 35th anniversary of the UN Declaration on the Right to Development at the Human Rights Council in Geneva, Mr. Türk highlighted the Accord's insistence on the indivisibility of economic, social, cultural, civil and political rights. One right should not be prioritized over another, the High Commissioner explained, as he insisted that political freedoms were not more vital than social or cultural rights, just as civic freedoms were no less important than achieving economic rights.
We are seeing inequalities escalating to perilous proportions. Climate change and biodiversity loss are far outpacing our corrective efforts. I'm convinced that progress in realizing the full spectrum of human rights can reverse this destructive spiral.
In a call for all UN member states to acknowledge their interdependence and to work together, the UN Rights Chief warned that key sustainable development goals have been knocked badly off track since the COVID-19 pandemic. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
For radio as godless as our Constitution, tune in to Free Thought Radio. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. We are co-hosts of Free Thought Radio, radio for the rest of us, freethinkers, atheists, and agnostics.
Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
From the secular point of view.
That's right. That's coming up Friday. That's coming up Friday tomorrow on Radio Free Kansas. And here in the second hour is the latest.
How do we stop ourselves sleepwalking into another Great Depression? It's breathtaking, you know, for folks that are listening to this. I don't know if they realise the extent of the tax injustice issue, that you've got these major corporations and rich people that go offshore with the money. People get away with it.
World leaders meet and they discuss the big issues, inequality, climate crisis, but the whole thing is a charade.
I think prison should be very real for accounting professionals who advise on aggressive tax avoidance schemes, without a doubt.
What we know about how the mainstream media reported on the financial crisis is that the deeper structural problems with the banking sector weren't really covered.
The majority of the public now understand that there is an emergency. People need to know that there's something that can be done.
There is a new dawn which is happening. The resistance is coming from the old guard.
This opens up a crucial debate about how humankind wants to develop over the course of the coming century.
Join me, Naomi Fowler, and John Christensen for the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. We talk about how we take back control from the super rich and powerful and make our economies work for all of us. You can find us on most podcast apps and your favourite radio station can broadcast us for free. Get more information on us on www.taxjustice.net/TaxCast. See you there.
Well, you don't have to wait or go and click, but you should. You know, you can click TaxCast at the Tax Justice Network or wait and listen in the second hour. In the second hour, we'll have the latest, the absolute latest of their TaxCast broadcast hosted by Naomi Fowler. And now, here is the latest this morning's headlines from Democracy Now!
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments Tuesday in two challenges to the Biden administration's student debt relief plan, which could give tens of millions of federal borrowers up to $20,000 of relief each. Several conservative justices expressed skepticism over the plan, while liberal justice Sonia Sotomayor blasted the Republican states that brought one of the lawsuits, arguing 50 million students will suffer if the program is rescinded and that the Education Department should be making decisions about how to handle their debt rather than judges. Activists gathered outside the court. This is Maddie Clifford of the Debt Collective.
These lawsuits are bogus. Literally backed by right-wing billionaires. Look it up. Rich people who've happily accepted government handouts in the form of having their PPP loans forgiven or receiving government subsidies. Does the government work for them or does it work for us? That's my question. Okay? So if you ask me now what it feels like to be $120,000 in student loan debt, I say it feels like solidarity. It feels like power. If one person owes the bank, that's not one person's problem. But when a million people owe the bank, that's the bank's problem.
Later in the show, we'll speak with Debt Collective organizer and writer Eleni Shermer. Elsewhere in Washington, D.C., the Senate Judiciary Committee held a hearing Tuesday for the Equal Rights Amendment, which would codify gender equality in the Constitution. The ERA was passed in 1972, but was never ratified, as conservative opponents have argued the deadline for ratification is passed. The ERA would not only help address persistent inequality in areas like wages, it could also protect abortion rights and the rights of trans and non-binary people. Constitutional and legal experts say Congress has the authority to change the ratification timeline. This is lawyer and constitutional scholar Kathleen Sullivan speaking at yesterday's hearing.
It's my belief that under Article 5, Congress proposed it, 38 states ratified it. It is the law now, and the only thing standing in the way, is the congressional deadline, which Congress set in 1972, altered in 1978, and has the power to change today.
Tuesday's hearing came as Washington, D.C. Circuit Court struck down a case which would have compelled the U.S. Archivist to publish and certify the Equal Rights Amendment as part of the Constitution. In Nigeria, Bola Tinubu of the ruling All Progressives Congress Party was declared the winner of the weekend's presidential election, but his opponents have disputed the results, alleging fraud, while election observers and voters have cited delays, closures, and violence at voting sites. Turnout was less than 30%. Tinubu, the former governor of Lagos, lost the vote in Lagos State to the Labor Party's Peter Obi, who came in third overall. Obi had received much of his support from young voters who saw him as the candidate of change. Atiku Abubakar of the main opposition party, People's Democratic Party, received the second highest number of votes according to Nigeria's Electoral Commission. The new president of Africa's most populous nation will have to face the ongoing security and violence crisis, as well as double-digit inflation and unprecedented oil theft. Iranian authorities say they're investigating after a series of poisonings at girls' schools. The latest such attack struck a school in the city of Pardis in Tehran province Tuesday. Nearly 700 schoolgirls have suffered toxic poisoning since November, and what authorities have said is an attempt to shut down education for girls and could be linked to the nationwide women's rights protests in Iran that took off in September following the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini in police custody. No students have been killed in the attacks, but many have reported respiratory problems and other health effects. Back in the United States, President Biden's tapped Deputy Secretary of Labor Julie Sue to be the next Labor Secretary as former Boston Mayor Marty Walsh leaves his post this month to head the National Hockey League's Players Union. The nomination of Sue, a civil rights attorney and former head of California's Labor Department, was welcomed by progressive and pro-labor groups. She would be the first Asian American to serve as secretary in Biden's cabinet. Amy Allison, founder of She the People, said, quote, Julie Sue's commitment to ensuring equity and compliance to her work as a labor expert and attorney fighting for the rights of women workers nationally makes her the ideal choice to lead the Labor Department. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. Meanwhile, Democrats reintroduced the PRO Act Tuesday for the third time. The legislation would protect the right to organize and penalize companies who engage in union busting. This is Senator Bernie Sanders.
Under this bill, it will no longer be cheaper for corporations to break the law than to obey the law. At a time when we are seeing, and here's good news, more and more workers wanting to join unions, it is unacceptable that over half of workers who vote to form a union don't have a union contract a year after their union victory. That will change under the PRO Act.
In Mississippi, Republican Governor Tate Reeves has signed into law a bill that bans gender-affirming health care for transgender youth. The legislation criminalizes providing transition-related care to minors, frees health insurance companies from having to cover gender-affirming care for youth, and blocks public funding for clinics and institutions that offer this type of care. Mississippi is at least the fifth state in the United States to ban health care for trans youth. In just the past month, Utah and South Dakota enacted trans health care bans, and the Oklahoma House just passed a similar measure. Two other bans in Alabama and Arkansas are currently being challenged in federal court. In Arkansas, the legislature has also voted to advance a bill that criminalizes trans adults for using public restrooms when children are present. In Tennessee, Republican Governor Bill Lee is facing backlash after a high school photo of him dressed in drag went viral just days after he said he plans to sign a bill that criminalizes drag performances. The measure bans drag shows from being performed in public or in front of children. Nationwide, at least 14 bills have been introduced, including in Arizona, Texas, and Tennessee, targeting drag shows, with performers and supporters saying these measures have worsened harassment and threats from far-right groups. Several drag storytime events for kids at libraries and other public places have been targeted by right-wing groups, including armed protesters. Some 30 million people across the United States are seeing a portion of their federal food assistance taken away today. The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, had increased benefits as part of the emergency response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Some households could lose hundreds of dollars each month, even as families continue to face increased food prices, and analysts warn the cuts will bring millions to a hunger cliff. Congressmember Pramila Jayapal said, quote, it's unacceptable. Poverty and hunger are policy choices. It's time we step up and do more, she said. And in Chicago, Mayor Lori Lightfoot conceded Tuesday evening after losing her bid for re-election. An April 4th runoff will pit Paul Vallas, the former superintendent of Chicago Public Schools, who's backed by the Fraternal Order of Police, and progressive Brandon Johnson, a Cook County commissioner and organizer for the Chicago Teachers Union. This is Paul Vallas speaking to supporters last night.
We will have a safe Chicago. We will make Chicago the safest city in America.
In Chicago's election, Paul Vallas received about 34% of the vote. Brandon Johnson placed second with just over 20%. On Tuesday night, Johnson criticized Vallas' record.
He is backed by the same forces who have done nothing as crime has paralyzed our city. He's backed by the same supporters who have failed to enforce the consent decree, even after Adam Toledo, Laquan McDonald were killed.
Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot placed third in Tuesday's race. 4 years ago, she became the first black woman and openly gay Chicago mayor, but she came under intense criticism during her term, including for her handling of the pandemic, racial justice protests, the Chicago teachers strike, crime levels, and skyrocketing property taxes. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're joined by the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist Seymour Hersh on his expose regarding an aspect of the war in Ukraine.
It's clear that the United States blew up the pipeline between Russia and Germany. This will have tremendous effects, and it has not been reported by the mainstream media. In one of its first moves, the newly elected Republican House of Representatives spent days fashioning a resolution condemning socialism.
We have on Jeff Mackler, a socialist activist, to expose the real agenda behind the passage of the resolution.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. The war in Ukraine is illegal. It's a violation of international law. Peace forces in the United States are demanding a ceasefire and negotiations and the recognition of Russia's legitimate security concerns, sure. And of course, at the same time, we recognize that the Russians were provoked by the U.S. and NATO into invading Ukraine, having, placed so many military bases and bombs on Russia's border. The latest development of enormous economic and political consequences, though, is the American blowing up of the two pipelines that provided cheap Russian natural gas to Europe. The great investigative journalist Seymour Hersh has recently discovered and published a hugely significant investigative article on Substack proving that the United States, despite its vehement denials, was in fact responsible for the blowing up of those two pipelines. This was done to prevent the integration of Russia into the European economy, because now the United States and Norway sell liquefied natural gas and plain old natural gas to Western Europe at 4 or 5 times the price of Russian gas. Well, we speak today with the wonderful journalist Seymour Hersh. In the past, Hersh's important articles were published in the New York Times, the New Yorker, and such, but not now. His article on the U.S. blowing up of the two pipelines had to be self-published on his Substack platform. Seymour Hersh, of course, has won a Pulitzer Prize and 5 Polk Awards, beginning with his expose of the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, where American troops killed 500 women, children, and old men. Well, Cy Hersh, welcome to Law and Disorder.
I'm so happy to be on Law and Disorder.
Cy, first question, obviously, how did you uncover the truth? How did you discover that the U.S. was responsible for blowing up those two Nord Stream pipelines? After all, the Biden administration had vehemently denied it, blamed the Russians and what have you. How did you get to the truth here?
Well, it's not so much of what made me think about it. I have a wonderful friend. He was a Middle Eastern, born in Syria, but ran out of the country. Anyway, ended up becoming multi-zillionaire in oil. And he's very brilliant, just lives and reads and thinks all day. After I did the story, he called me and he said, "Oh, Cy," he said, "you have become the master of deconstruction of the obvious. Come on, the president said I'm going to do it. Victoria Nuland said one way or another, this is in..." What happened is after My Lai, pretty early after My Lai, there were a lot of people that were in that war, you know, went in, you know, young officers and young intelligence people and people in the Phoenix program thinking I'm really going to do something. And what happened to them is they learned very quickly that all the U.S. Army wanted to do was kill gooks. And so there's a lot of disillusionment, but people stayed in. And so then I start doing My Lai. And so that attracts people, because the people I deal with are the people on the inside who want to be on the inside, you know, many family histories, you know, who, you know, they understand that they're taking the oath of office, not to their boss, not to the general, not to the president, but to the Constitution. That's what they understand. They really do. And so that's how, from by the time I got to the New York Times in early 70s, I was wheeling, you know, and I did a lot of stuff there, all, by the way, with anonymous sources. Anonymous sources are very interesting for newspapers, because if they want to run it, nobody cares about the anonymous source. If they don't want to run it, why, it's the fault that it's anonymous. And, you know, and after all those years of writing anonymously about sources, I just, that's just the way it is. It's a different media today. I think Trump did it. He, you know, we now have Fox News and the New York Post, et cetera, versus the New York Times and sometimes the Washington Post. And so you have a whole different political structure. In the Vietnam days, the Senate Democrats, with a lot of moderate Republicans, passed the all sorts of legislation. The War Powers Act, insisting that in 1973, that it got us on the road to getting out as much as anything else. And can you imagine Chuck Schumer today saying, "I want an investigation of the Senate"? Not a chance. It's just not going to happen. They're just too polarized. They've got a Democratic president, and who frankly scares the hell out of me, but that's okay. And his gaggle, Tony Blinken and Nuland and Sullivan, I call them Winken, Blinken, and Nod. They're so alike in their venom and towards all things Russia long before this. And also, we had Tony Blinken point his finger at his Russian counterpart in public with the press watching in China. Mm. You know, I mean, what are they doing? What's their game plan? So that's one. So anyway, and I will tell you something that I've told other reporters since this story. The people in the pipeline business, some of them are Americans who own companies that build pipelines. The pipelines weren't, the first legislation about underwater pipe materials goes back to 1884 when the telegraph. And there was an international agreement we signed then if you inadvertently with a boat or something cut into a line, you're liable for damages, et cetera. It was updated, and we signed it again in 1898 or 99. Since then, there's been no specific legislation about a pipeline, although it's clear, I did a lot of law review looking at this, it's clear you can sanction, you can get economic sanction, but it's not clear where criminality comes in. They're trying to get the people in the LOC, the law of business, law of the sea business, are trying to get it rewritten, the codes, to include pipelines. There's 12,000 pipelines. But the people who build pipelines and finance pipelines were involved in the actual work of getting, there were two pipelines, Nord Stream 1, which was owned by Gazprom, and there's also another one, Nord Stream 2. The first one came online in 2011. The new one was sanctioned by the Germans, and the Germans stopped it because under American pressure. It was built, finished in 2021. Anyway, the people in the business absolutely are convinced. That doesn't mean they know, but from early on, only people were Washington. That's what they were saying. But that's not credible. So in October, while talking about something else, a month after the incident happened, I was dealing with something else with somebody who I have people I've been dealing with forever, and I asked about it, and that started about 3 months of a lot of work to figure out everything, and I eventually got to Norway, And then I learned, as I wrote just the other day, that Norwegians were involved in a lot of the dirty stuff we were doing in North Vietnam that pushed that Johnson finally got a chance to tell a lie and get us into the Gulf of Tonkin. And with the lie, it got us into a war that killed, we usually say, between 2 and 3 million Vietnamese and 58,000 American guys, with who knows how many coming out with injuries and severe mental problems off the war. I saw this pipeline as potentially a game changer, because I don't think there's any question that Biden had an option from January on. He pulled the trigger in late September, when it was very clear on the inside, even though you don't read this in the Times and Post federally, that at best you're going to get a very bitter, murderous stalemate, and probably not. And so winter was coming, and he was very worried that the pipeline Nord Stream 2, Nord Stream 1 had already been shut down by Putin in anger at the rhetoric from Washington. And Nord Stream 2 was, as I say, controlled by the German government, and Biden's issue was, would Schulz, and, you know, it's a very mercantile society. The Germans have been riding high on cheap natural gas. They actually had enough so they retailed some of it themselves, and the Russians and the Gazprom and the companies that own Gazprom didn't mind that. And here comes another one online, which was going to be a boon. They were going to have gas forever. And I think my heuristic thought is that I've been told this, but that doesn't, people telling me with this kind of stuff, nobody knows what the president's mind. He decided he had to prevent the Germans, with fall coming, and maybe it wasn't a bad winter, but he had to prevent them from defecting from his war and backing off, and NATO backing off in Western Europe, because it wasn't as popular as you think. You know, we were putting tons of money in, and the Germans certainly didn't want to put more in. And he was afraid they would just release the sanctions. The chancellor was in charge, and start using Russian gas. In other words, what they described it as Blinken later described it after the blow up, about 4 days afterwards, he said in a speech that no more can Russia weaponize gas. And that notion of Russia, and with its natural resources, weaponizing their influence in the Western Europe, goes back to the Kennedy days. Really, about the idea, always worried about, you know, this is the whole containment madness. Saigon falls in May, April, when all those horrible pictures, 75, to the dirty communists. Cambodia fell to a faction that was largely communist. Vientiane, that was about 2 days, 2 weeks later. I should have these dates better in mind. Vientiane and Laos fell eventually, became more or less communist controlled. So the whole containment notion that led us into this war, this is the whole reason we were fighting the war, to contain red China, communist China, from controlling it all, and all went down. And guess what happened? Nothing. You know, we're the largest trader of Vietnam with Vietnam right now. Their largest trading partner is us. All that stuff made me think the only person had a reason to do it. So when I began to ask questions, the answers came very quickly. Well, of course we did. And I'll tell you one more thing. The power of the president is enormous. He can test the intelligence community. He can go to this new Office of National Intelligence, they're the super lords of the intelligence community. And their intelligence, the guy who runs the direction of the intelligence office for the ONI, that's the one number one office. You can go there and test them for an all source, SIGINT, all everything, study of who did it. He can also test the DI, and the CIA. They have operations division. They also have an intelligence, the DI, Director of Intelligence. Does a lot of good work, a lot of assets. He could test them. For the spooks, for the covert guys, there's another little separate unit. I think they used to call it the C, an intelligence unit, because you got guys around the world, and you have to be monitoring all the communications around them and make sure nobody's onto them. He could have tasked them, and I will tell you right now, he never asked anybody to give him an example of who did it. You have to be a genius to know why? Because he knows who did it. He knows there's no reason to ask that question. I mean, it'll come out. It'll just come out.
Cy, by destroying the pipelines,
Will this seriously affect the economies of Western Europe?
Are you kidding? Let's see. Right now, even though it was a mild winter, that was a big factor. Two things were a big factor this year. One, September, late September, gave particularly the Germans enough time to buy liquefied natural gas right away from us at two or three times the price. That wasn't very happy of. That was a dumb move by us. But anyway, they did. And because the economy in China, because of COVID, has been very slow, the Chinese sold them a lot of. So they got up to about 73% of what they needed. And that got them through a mild winter. But they have no ability now to do the same for next winter. And that's when the panic is on. It got colder in January, and the complaining from Germany got louder. And I was asked to do, in the last week, go to a conference at the Max Planck Institute, which is the, sort of the super Harvard of Berlin anyway, Germany. And they're all in a dither about what to do because the United States, which always, you know, we were the go-to guy for Western Europe. There's no natural products there. They don't have their gas and oil. We were the guy. And we've just told them, you know, I want to keep this crazy losing war in Ukraine going. You know, this corrupt country that couldn't have got into NATO if it stood at its head. And by the way, Russia has yet to commit any of its real army. And all the intelligence people I know, as you're already hearing, I'm sure, if you have friends in it, are much more dire about what's going to happen. It's just going to be a meat grinder for the Russians in the next couple of months. They're going to start an offense soon, and it's going to be pretty bad. And, you know, I don't know what Biden's going to do then. Why is he doing it? Well, presidents always get popular in wars.
I want to say, do you think that what you've been describing will be enough to bring about, in fact, there's been reports in the Washington Post today, the New York Times, about how the coalition, which is held together reasonably well, is beginning to show some strains. And to what extent might what you've been describing have an impact on the political willingness of the German government and people to continue supporting the war in Ukraine? What do you think about that?
One answer is, of course, who gives a hoot about what I think, but I haven't gotten beyond that because I can tell you that a lot of people from the Bundestag have been calling me, and I stay away from that. I don't talk to anybody in politics. I never testified before a committee. I just didn't want to. I just wanted to stay away from it. And Kohl may have a problem because the question that both some on the left, the right there is awful because they're so much against immigration and they're very vicious sort of people. But and by the way, the Green Party, which used to be left, is now sort of a pro-war party. Everything changes. It's so much changed in the last decade in Germany in politics. But Kohl has a problem because there was a talk that in February this year, by the way, imagine if you're a group of guys, you know, working out of Norway, and Norway has a long history with us of down and dirty tricks, come on, all the way back, particularly in the Vietnam War early on. But and so you're working in Norway, and you're consulting with the pretty interesting guy that's the head of the CIA, he's an interesting guy because I think he's learning a lot. And so the question is, how much does he want to know? Well, maybe he doesn't want to know that much of what he's doing, but I assure you that the seniors in the White House don't know. I mean, they don't want to know. They want the result. They want to ask questions, but they don't really know much about what's going on. That's just the way it has to be if you're running a really seriously covert operation. You don't, because you worry about talk. And one of the reasons they worry particularly is they eventually told Burns, I think they have respect for him. He came in and he brought his own people on the State Department, INR intelligence. He didn't bring people in from the operations division. And I'll tell you right now, anybody that tries to run that agency without bringing in, you know, the not only the brains of the covert side, but also the knuckle draggers, can't make it. They work against them. You know, what can I tell you? I've known that people for 40 years. They're tough. Anyway. But they told the White House in January, we could do it. I mean, we think we know how to do it. We've got the people. The problem was to find the right spot, and the Norwegians knew more about the Baltic Sea. It's 750 miles long, and you can't show up with divers there because there's no oil there. You know, you can't have a bunch of divers going down and digging around. So they told them that. Within 10 days, Victoria Nuland, who in my book is just not as smart as people think she is. Remember that famous conversation she was overheard, intercepted up in 2014, trying to pick the leader of the new government in Kiev. She's doing a briefing, and somebody mentioned something about Nord Stream 2, and she says, "Let me tell you," she said, "by one way or another, that pipeline's not going to be built." It was in January 20th or something like that. And then 3 weeks later, I think 20 days later, the 7th. By the way, I use New Yorker editors who aren't there anymore, and New Yorker fact checkers, because they're the best, and I have to do that. And on the 7th of February, with Schultz there, Biden, and you can understand Biden maybe thinks he can back down Putin, but by then already they began to move up the hospital corps, the vans with operating rooms, and once that getting to Belarus, you know it's coming. But even so, he had a briefing with Schultz, and he was asked by the reporter, somebody asked him about Nord Stream 2, and he says, "That's not going to happen. We're going to stop it." And a reporter said, "Well, how are you going to do that?" "Let me tell you, if they go, we know how to do it. These aren't the right words, but the import was the same. We know how to do it. We will do it." And that's a quote that just doesn't exist anymore. In the subsequent stories that were written by the New York Times and Washington Post about whether, you know, there were stories last fall, who did it and what.
Cy Hirsch, Jim and I want to ask you, why did you self-publish your investigation on Substack? I mean, why did you do that? Why didn't you get it published on a major outlet like the Times? And what has been the impact of your sensational revelation?
Do you notice what the Times and Post, what their politics are? Biden apparently had a conversation with his counterpart in Russia. And this morning paper began it was briefed to the press, began on the front page, unless it was yesterday's morning, but I think it was just this morning's, had five paragraphs all about how Blinken told him this and told him that and blah, blah, blah. Then Ned Price, the spokesman, who used to be in the CIA, he's just, you know, wind him up and he says what you want. Added to it, I haven't looked at the jump yet, but eventually I think they might get to what the Russians said about that meeting. When I was at the New York Times, you couldn't get away with that stuff. You couldn't get away with some of the language you used about Russia. Well, for no cause whatever, he went in there. The language has changed so much in that paper. And I was in 72. I was just a kid. I did the Mili. I had trouble getting on a newspaper. And I went to see William Shawn of the New Yorker, because I always read the New Yorker. And in 5 minutes, he hired me. But the New York Times and Washington Post won't. I don't know what planet they're on. And then I left them to go to the Times, because the editor of the Times, A. Rosenthal, told me essentially that they were screwing up the war. And not in the field. Halberstam and Homer Biggert, if you remember those names, and David and Neil Sheehan were doing great reporting for the Times from the field. But Washington was, as it always is, you know, looking at their president and the national, you know, their people more. Kissinger was also a big player at the Washington Bureau. But I went there, and I had the halcyon days. Anonymous sources, I could write about anything. Nobody worried about it. Those are different days. I wouldn't go to the Times now because they wouldn't publish me like today. I mean, I see the change in the paper. And one of the things is, when I was there, it was 1.7 circulation. Now, paper. Now it's about 310, 320. They don't care about it. I'm a subscriber every morning, but they don't care. They've got 15 or 20 different blogs and podcasts going. That's the thing of interest. I don't quite know what's going on. It's not very objective reporting about the Ukraine war. That doesn't mean you like Russia. You know, who likes what Putin does? He started the first war, the bloodiest war in Europe since World War II. There's been other wars, you know, the Balkans and other, and Chechnya. But you know, this is something else. You know, you can't like him for that. But it's not without some cause. He's got 800 miles from him. He's got American missiles that overnight could be turned in. They're defensive, but they could be turned around. Believe me, I know that. And 8 minute ride to downtown, you know, enough to take out all of Moscow with the power we have. And so he's got some cause. What blowing up the pipelines did in that cause? He's blowing up the pipeline because he hopes he can hold on to European support for Ukraine, because he knows in September the 26th, that was the day. And I went back to a lot of guys just in the last month and said, you know, there's other intelligence people in the world. know. I mean, don't get stuck on one thing. There's other people. They're mm-hmm. allies of us, but they also have the same intel. Anyway, I mean, I don't want to overdo this, but I'm just telling you, I think we have a real problem with Joe Biden. You know, it doesn't seem that the rhetoric doesn't change. And I'll tell you something else nobody's looked at. If you look at the politics of Russia and 2 years ago, when we began to beat them up verbally when they got in, the chances of Putin getting public support for a war was zero. You know, it would have been 30-40%. And over the 6, 8, 9 months of comments, attacks on him and all that stuff, and that was tit for tat for sure. And the more Putin complained about Putin, the better Putin's polls were. I mean, about Biden, the better it got, it seemed. I'm sure that helped that way. But you could really argue, and I will tell you this, there's been an assessment of this inside, not that they're ever going to release it, that you know, that part of the factor that got him into the position where he thought he could go, 70% of the population supporting him now, was the aggression we did. And yes, there was a terrible mess, what he called, for a draft. Remember that? But again,
yes.
I'm old enough to remember in 65, 66 when his name is Hershey, General Hershey, began to push the draft. And I can't tell you how many more than the 3,000 people that were prosecuted there were that weren't prosecuted, that simply tore up their thing and left, or left or just ignored it. They thought, you know, they were, you know, it wasn't like a third as it was in Moscow.
Cy, I signed up this morning to read your investigative reporting on Substack, and I'd like you to tell our listeners how they can read that also.
If you go to seymourhirsch.substack.com, it'll open up, and that first story I wrote is there for everybody. And after that, because that's the way it works in the world today, the next two articles were in a paywall, but it's, you know, people, you have to pay $5 or something like that to read it, $5 a month. It isn't about money, believe me. Substack, I knew from a friend of mine, a young colleague who used to be at the Rolling Stone, Matt Taibbi. I knew that he had really done very well in Substack in terms of getting out issues, and ran into a lot of trouble by liking Musk. But what he's writing about was the NSA and CIA's ability to manipulate Twitter. And that's a very serious story, and I will tell you that was a very serious operation. That wasn't done by accident. They wanted to get in and begin to manipulate Twitter. You know, every time you got the agency manipulating, ostensibly for national security reasons, it always ends up, and Taibbi's been showing this, it gets to be for political purposes too. You know, to always help out the president, whatever. You know, I'm somebody who wrote about domestic spying in the United States that was not known for 8 years. The CIA could operate for 8 years without, you know, don't think they're not competent. My God. This operation they did, you know, there's a bunch of OSINT people, all open source intelligence, saying, well, the boat wasn't there and all that. I'm telling you, the guys running this operation love that OSINT because they could have a Marmada in there, but the signal's coming up and OSINT picking it up. And the plane, they said no plane flew. Three days ago, the president went to flew from Poland into Kiev, and the stories even wrote how the plane that flew him in dismantled their transponder. Everybody has an idea of a transponder for making sure everybody in the world knows where they are. And all you do is turn it off, folks. I have to deal with. I don't want to educate a bunch of guys about what open source intelligence is because, you know, they're so convinced they're right. They keep on saying the ship I named wasn't there. Well, it was there, but of course you didn't know it because it wasn't using the signal you think it was. You know, I mean, it's so dumb.
Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder. Every success with the articles that I know you'll continue to write about this tremendous development, and we're hoping that it'll do something to help end this war. Cy Hirsch, thanks again for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me, guys. Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. Checking troubleshooting, moving.
February 2nd of this year, the now Republican-controlled U.S. House of Representatives passed a resolution denouncing the horrors of socialism. It passed overwhelmingly in a 328-86-14 vote. More than half the Democrats voted for it, while 86 voted against and 14 voted present. The resolution is made up of lies and half-truths. We urge listeners to read it for themselves. It's online. The resolution is 3 pages in length, and 99% of it consists of a series of whereas clauses pointing out what the Republican authors of the resolution believe are examples of the horribles of socialism. What is socialism? Socialism has never really existed anywhere, yet there have been attempts, starting with the Great Russian Revolution of 1917, which effectively ended the slaughter of World War I. It was overthrown in 1991 when the USA and others successfully restored capitalism to the Soviet Union. What would a socialist society be like? First of all, it would be democratic, politically and economically, and it would not be run by the 1%. America has a rich history of electing people with a socialist vision. Socialism would eliminate racism and economic want. It would provide for education and health care, housing and employment for everybody. Production would be for human needs, not for profit. It would clean up the environment and eliminate the threat of catastrophic man-made climate change. To counter the false image of socialism propagated by the U.S. Congress, we speak today with Jeff Mackler. Jeff is the National Secretary of Socialist Action and was their candidate for president in 2016 and in 2020. Mr. Mackler also serves as the Administrative Committee of the United National Anti-War Coalition, or UNAC. He's the Director of the Mobilization of Free Mumia Abu Jamal and a Steering Committee member of the National Julian Assange Defense Committee. A lifelong activist, Jeff Mackler is the author of 25 books and pamphlets on political, economic, and anti-U.S. imperial war movements. Jeff Mackler, a warm welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Glad to be with you.
Jeff, is it fair to say that all the countries, both current and historical, that are mentioned in the House resolution as socialist nations are really not? And if so, then please tell our listeners what you believe a truly socialist nation would look like. On racism, for example, Malcolm X said that he did not believe you could eliminate racism under capitalism any more than a chicken could lay a duck's egg. And then he concluded that if it ever did, it would be a pretty revolutionary chicken. Please talk about racism, democratic rights, free speech, health care, housing, war, peace, employment in a socialist society.
Well, that's a great question. I remember Malcolm also saying when he was asked about black Democrats, his definition was fire on one end and fool on the other. And that is, he was losing confidence in the capacity of the Democrats or Republicans to make any change. I think that the Black Lives Matter movement, which is unprecedented probably in history, 25 million people mobilized a couple of years ago, and they marked that this society is replete with systemic racism. And that is, it's not an accident, it's part of the system. Of course, the socialist society understands that racism is central to capitalist functioning, and that is, it needs to divide working people. If they can get away with paying one person less, like a black man or a Latino, it pushes a downward pressure on all wages. But I'm more or less astonished at the nature of the House resolution that you refer to. Here's a resolution written by perhaps the richest core of legislators in the world. I don't think there's a single member of the House who is not a millionaire, if not a multi-millionaire. And they represent the billionaires and the trillionaires who really run the country and elect them in the first place. So I think it's a poor joke that the richest class in the world is decrying an effort by working people to live a decent life.
It's disgusting, of course, what American capitalism has been able to do in terms of distorting what socialism is and distorting even who historically have been socialists in this country. Martin Luther King was essentially a socialist. So was Helen Keller, the famous blind and deaf woman who, despite her disabilities, figured it out. Even Frederick North Olmsted, the designer of Central Park, was a socialist. Socialists have been elected to national, state, citywide offices around the time of World War I. And of course, then the government has been doing all it can to crush them. We have a rich history of socialism, however little the American people may know of that, don't we, Jeff?
You might add Albert Einstein to the list. He was also a socialist that decried the war-making capitalist system. I think that a good picture of socialism, as opposed to the first couple of lines of the House resolution that declares that socialism under Lenin and the Bolshevik Revolution was a murderous system that killed millions of people, I think a quick look at that revolution would be revealing. On day one, upon defeating the Tsar in the largest country in the world, the working class organized in councils of workers, peasants, and soldiers in the middle of a war passed a few decrees. That's on day one, October 1917. What were these decrees? What did these so-called evil socialists do? The first thing they did was they nationalized all the land and gave it to the peasants. That was the largest land reform in the history of the world. Second, they decreed the right of freedom, self-determination, and secession for all of the oppressed nationalities. That's where socialists in the United States get the idea that there should be no racist oppression in the United States, that all people, black, white, Latino, Asian, should be treated equal. Well, that's what the Bolsheviks, who the House resolution decries, did on day one. They gave the right of the conquered nations, of the colonies of the Tsarist Empire, the largest in the world, to secede, to vote, to leave. And some did, like Finland, which was basically a Tsarist-controlled conquered nation. They gave them the right to their language. And they did a few other things. They decreed the right to free medical care, to quality housing, to an end to discrimination based on gender preference. They literally taught classes to working people on gender equality. This is 1917, not 2017 or 2023. The most important thing they did, these horrible Bolsheviks, is they announced that they were leaving World War I. The United States was allied with Tsarist Russia and Japan against the Axis powers, Germany and the Middle Eastern countries, in a war that took the lives of tens of millions of people. And on day one, the Bolsheviks moved to get out of the war. I mean, a simple idea that working people shouldn't kill each other for capitalist profits. And what do I mean by capitalist profits? This was a world war to fight over the distribution of the colonies of imperialism everywhere in the world. If I could tell you an unusual story, when I was a kid, my dad got me a Rand McNally map, one of these 8-foot by 6-foot maps of Africa that he put on my wall in my bedroom. And as I was going to bed, I was probably 13 years old, listening to the Lone Ranger and his Indian companion Tonto fight for law and order in the early West, I looked at the map because I had nothing else to do before I went to sleep. And the map was quite interesting. It had countries like Southwest, French Equatorial Africa, Spanish Guinea, French Equatorial Africa, British Rhodesia, Anglo-Egyptian Sudan, Portuguese Angola, Spanish Sahara, In other words, the entire map of Africa was divided between the colonial powers, and the horror that they imposed on those people was unprecedented in world history. And I'm not exaggerating. It was the first time in that colonial era that capitalism depopulated, reduced the population of an entire continent, with the leader in the horror being King Leopold in Belgium, who slaughtered 12 million people and extracted the rights to the ivory and rubber in that country. I might add one point, the rights to the mineral resources in the Congo at the turn of the century, that is 1902 or 3, went to the Rockefeller and J.P. Morgan Trust, who today run J.P. Morgan Chase, the richest bank in the world. So capitalism has a rather an evil history, whereas socialism, the first example of it, when working people took power democratically through their own organizations, they liberated humanity in a sixth of the land of the planet, giving people the land, the right to control their ideas, the right to plan their economy, the right to grant free, organize for free medical care and health care, the right for divorce, the end to discrimination. That was quite an achievement, whereas the House said that they were butchers that slaughtered 10 million people.
This is Michael Smith. I'm co-hosting Law and Disorder with my former law partner, Jim Lafferty, and we're speaking today with Jeff Mackler. Jeff is the head of the Socialist Action Party. Jeff, why do you think the Republicans, as one of their first moves, took the opportunity to denounce socialism? And are we now in a new era of McCarthyism?
I think it's part and parcel of the bipartisan politics of both parties to cut social services to the bone. They've done this, whether it be Clinton in office or any other president in recent era. There's been a massive exchange from the poor to the rich. That is, the rich have socialism like never before. They pay lower taxes than ever before, if they pay taxes at all. And working people have been reduced to a significantly lower standard of living than at any time. So this is just the Republicans' way, propaganda-wise, there's nothing in it that specifies anything, to cut back on Social Security. In fact, one innocent Democrat, or perhaps not so innocent, tried to amend the House resolution saying Social Security and Medicare are not socialist. And that was defeated. It was the Republicans' way of saying, be prepared, we're going to balance the budget by spending more money on the military than ever before, and we're going to try to cut social services and Medicare and public education, health care in every form. Privatizing public services for the profit of the few is the norm for both parties.
Well, and I'm curious because of what you said. The Democrats have made a great show, Biden did at his State of the Union, of speaking up for Social Security and Medicare and calling the Republicans out on it. And the Democrats, as you pointed out, did make that whatever half-hearted effort to put that in the resolution we're talking about. But when it wasn't in the resolution and language was in it that suggested that programs like Social Security should not be part of governance here in the United States, nearly, or at least half of the Democrats nevertheless went along with it. What does that tell us?
Well, it tells us that we really have one party that represents capitalism. They get elected every 4 years or so by billionaire elections which are run by a tiny handful of people who select the idiots that are in Congress today. They know nothing about what they're doing. And when I say that, it's not an exaggeration. You know, when you had the Republican in the last debate when what's-his-name became the House Speaker, he had a fight with his own party because a minority, the right wing of his party, said we want the right to see the legislation we passed. And when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez did the same thing, she suggested maybe we won't elect Nancy Pelosi until we get an agreement that Biden would sign certain progressive legislation. Ocasio-Cortez said the same thing. She said, we peons in the House of Representatives, we don't write the legislation. We don't see it. It's thousands of pages of tax codes and details. One Republican, innocent or not so innocent, literally said, and I want the right to see the legislation 2 days and a half. And I want to say that all legislation has to be on one subject. That is, as opposed to the idea that every politician slips in their own little piece of legislation, making this or that section of the ruling richer than ever before. So the entire legislative process is fraught. As you said, when Biden first came to office, he proposed a $6 trillion, you know, progressive package, which he touted across the country. By the time the debate ended, it was reduced to like $1.3 trillion. They cut $5 trillion in promises to working people in order to balance the budget, in order to fund the military, in order to not tax the rich. So all of Biden's promises, like for example, he said during the Ukraine war, the war we have to stop the war profiteering. Well, the United States spends more money on war than virtually the entire world combined. This country, this so-called democracy, maintains 1,100 military bases in 110 countries around the world, whereas the evil Russians, and believe me, I'm no Putin fan, he's a minor imperialist player, Putin has 6 military bases outside of Russia, and the vicious Chinese, they have 1 military base in Djibouti at the Horn of Africa, as opposed to the United States' 1,100. So if you're talking about oppression, colonialism, slaughter, you're talking about the United States. The resolution that the House passed condemns Venezuela and Iran. That's because the United States, once again, is trying to get their oil. They happen to be the two richest reserve nations with reserves in oil in the world. So suddenly they want to demonize. And the embargo and the sanctions of Venezuela has, according to United Nations rapporteur, killed 50,000 people. This kind of slaughter, the resolution condemns Cuba. But the Cubans fought against the Batista dictatorship that slaughtered 60,000 people. The resolution condemns Nicaragua. But the Nicaraguans removed the U.S.-backed Somoza dictatorship that slaughtered 80,000 people before it was taken over by the Nicaraguan masses. The same thing with the Guatemalan dictatorship and the Chilean dictatorship of Pinochet. These are the real horrors of capitalist society.
Jeff Mackler, we're seeing the resurgence of a proto-fascist movement in America. The great German playwright and political figure Bertolt Brecht said that in order to understand fascism, you must look at capitalism from where it springs. Your thoughts on this, please.
Well, Brecht was right. He also had a humorous response when he said, if you don't like the working class, you can always get a new one. And that is for those cynics who don't have confidence that working people, the vast majority, can build society in their own interests. That's what socialism is all about. It's about building majority rule. But Brecht was right. Every serious person who analyzes history understood that Hitler's fascism, Hitler's Germany, his rhetoric notwithstanding, and he was a, you know, rhetorician to say the least. He called his party the National Socialist Party. But the origins of all fascist regimes are capitalism. It's a capitalism where the ruling class loses confidence in the masses and can't resort to the typical, quote, democratic rule that we have in the United States, that is orchestrated elections by billionaires. So it has to result to repression, massive repression. Hitler's war killed 27 million Russians and an equal number of people around the world, 100 million. That was a capitalist war orchestrated by Hitler on behalf of the giant corporations in that country, many of which were working in collaboration and still dealing during the war with American corporations. It was another effort to redivide the world, redivide the colonies, redivide the continents. Fascism for a lifetime is based on the simple proposition that the vast majority of humanity should run society democratically in their own interest for human needs, not capitalist profit, that the wealth that working people produce should be democratically planned and orchestrated in order to build another world. Today, young people are more interested in socialism than any time in the modern era. A majority say that they prefer socialism over capitalism. And what do they mean by that? They believe that the evils that young people are so well aware of, racism, poverty, gender discrimination, all types of discrimination, global warming, pandemics, endless wars, union busting, are not accidents that can be remedied by the election of this or that party, but rather are inherent in the system of capitalism itself. And that system has to be changed. And the youth are going to be in the forefront. Young people, young working people who want a better life, who don't want to die of plagues like COVID. And by the way, the United States, the richest nation on earth, has the largest number and percentage of COVID dead in the entire world. 1.2 million people in an advanced civilization. What a horror.
You know, Jeff, picking up on that point, you've been fighting for, well, for a more just and equitable world, more peaceful world, for decades now. You're not a young man. And there has been some good news, and you've just pointed out the young people in America, for example, indicating their preference for a socialist country rather than a capitalist one. So as you now look ahead, given your vast experience over these past decades, are you hopeful? Are you still hopeful that what you've been working for may indeed finally come to pass here in the United States?
You know, I'm more hopeful than ever, even though, admittedly, it is a very dark time for the socialist movement. It's a contradiction. On the one hand, you have angry working people who are being negatively affected by every aspect of capitalist society. They're losing their homes. They can't pay their rent. They can't pay their bills. They can't pay their electricity. Their education is beyond, college education is beyond most people. So they're very angry, and yet they are momentarily, in my opinion, passive. If I were to review to you the state of most of the socialist groups in the United States, and there are many and varied and with important differences, we're at a low point. And that is that the generation that has radicalized during the Vietnam War and civil rights movement, that most people my age, and I'm going on 83 in April, participated in, those movements are long past. But I think we are going to see the kind of spontaneous developments, but with a serious leadership, that we saw 2 years ago. Out of nowhere, with the murder of George Floyd, 25 million people mobilized in some 3,000 U.S. cities, mostly black and white together, an amazing phenomena. Led by blacks, they challenged systemic racism, a racism that they believe goes to the marrow of the system itself. Those are the future, those young people, those mobilizations. And we're beginning to see working people do the same thing, beginning to resume organizing independent unions, beginning to fight the boss class and understand that the boss is not their friend anymore. I think that the working people in the United States are going to give a world-class accounting of themselves. They're not going to sit by as the environment is destroyed, as our cities burn, as thousands of people die from heat prostration around the world, as the United States produces more fossil fuel rather than less, and takes no significant steps towards ending climate disaster, which is rapidly coming. So I think what we're going to see is a new leadership emerging from young people, from working people, a leadership that understands that the issues of civil liberties and democratic rights and freeing journalists like WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who exposed U.S. war crimes, or political prisoners who are emblematic of the horror of the prison industrial complex like Mumia Abu-Jamal, all of these issues are united. They support democratic rights for oppressed people around the world, including Palestinians. So the struggle for freedom of political prisoners, indeed, if I may say, all prisoners, the first thing serious revolutionaries do everywhere on earth is free the prisons. That's what happened in the French Revolution of 1789, in the Russian Revolution, and every other progressive social movement. They took the people that the ruling class considered alien to their system, and they put them in jails. The United States is number one in the world in the number and percentage of its people in prison. Millions of people, the majority black and Latino, are in U.S. prisons. If for no other reason that the average wage of a prisoner in the United States is 50 cents an hour. For Pete's sake, why hire an immigrant for a minimum wage, $7.25 an hour, when you can have a virtual slave in an American privatized prison for 50 cents working for Fortune 500 companies. So I'm optimistic that a new leadership will emerge from these struggles. We're beginning to see the outlines of it. We will see a reconstruction of a fantastic united socialist movement that fights for humanity's best interests and the liberation of humanity around the world from the imperialist club of the United States.
Thank you, Jeff Mackler. Thank you very much. Jeff, unfortunately, we've come to an end of our allotted time, and I wanted to ask you if you would please just take a moment and tell people how they can follow your work and the work of the organizations that you are active in.
Well, I'm the National Secretary of Socialist Action, so you can go online and see our website at socialistaction.org and get involved, make a contribution, join, get involved in the struggles. We're active in the struggle to free Mumia and Julian Assange for civil liberties, democratic rights, abortion rights, anti-war struggles, climate mobilizations, every struggle where humanity reaches out to improve their lives and the lives of all working people. That's our cup of tea. That's what we do every day of the week, and we will make gains provided we can inspire working people to stand up against the current horrors of a system that has nothing but evil in its very bones. Thanks so much for giving me the opportunity to be with you. Check us out, socialistaction.org.
Well, Jeff Mackler, thank you, my friend. Thank you very much for being with us on Law and Disorder today. Your message is always a hopeful and inspiring one. I thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Coming up in the second hour here, I'm your host, Mike Cadell. Before we do the tax cast, in the grand old tradition of socialism, a band out of Boston.
together we don't stand.
There
is power in a union. Now the lessons of the past were all learned with workers' blood. The mistakes of the bosses we must make for. From the city to the farm and in trenches full of mud. Cause war has always been the boss's way, sir. Not defeat us, but who defend the workers who cannot organize? When the GOP send their attorneys out to seize us, come on!
Money speaks for money, the devil for his own. Who comes to speak for the skin and the bone?
What a comfort to the widow, a life for the child.
Yeah!
It's power.
Welcome to the TaxCast, the Tax Justice Network podcast. We're all about fixing our economies so they work for all of us. I'm your host, Naomi Fowler. You can find us on most podcast apps. Our website is www.thetaxcast.com. You can subscribe to the TaxCast there, or you can email me on naomi@taxjustice.net, and I'll put you on the subscribers list. Let me know what you think of the show. Okay, so on this month's TaxCast, the friend of organised crime and mafia networks is financial secrecy. Secrecy jurisdictions and tax havens have made it possible for mafias to progress from crossing physical borders with banknotes stuffed in suitcases to being able to pour unlimited amounts of money into the financial system. Dirty money in, clean money out. That money destabilizes economies and corrupts democracies, while mafias toxify societies using force and fear. But the problem is that financial secrecy and tax havens are also the friend of commerce, multinationals, and very wealthy, powerful people worldwide. That's why the obvious solution of opening up secrecy jurisdictions is so hard to achieve. I spend a lot of my time in Sicily. It's a place that's been limited for so long by the obsession people outside seem to have with the Sicilian mafia, the Cosa Nostra. Actually, the Cosa Nostra, as it once was, has been in decline for years. There's been a lot of determination and bravery on the part of some Italian police and investigators. In my local town, the days when the judge had to have 24-hour guards with machine guns outside his house are long over. Actually, he got sent to Calabria, where the southern Italian mafias have become an even greater threat. Back on the island of Sicily, though, something monumental just happened in January 2023.
Obiettivo identificato, lo abbiamo catturato.
After 30 years on the run, Italy's most wanted Cosa Nostra fugitive has been arrested. Matteo Messina Denaro boasted he could fill a graveyard with all his victims. You can hear the applause of passers-by gathered on the street when he got arrested. Some of them are trying to hug the policeman. One of them's tearful.
Bravissimi, bravi, bravi.
Matteo Messina Denaro was sentenced in his absence for murders including those of anti-mafia judges Giovanni Falcone and Paolo Borsellino in the 90s. That was a real turning point for many Sicilians. It's a wound that goes deep to this day. Most squares in Sicily are named after those two judges. In my local town square, there's a huge billboard with a famous photo of the two of them together. Written above it, it says, Città contro tutte le mafie, city against all mafias. Back to the arrest of Matteo Messina Denaro.
It's wonderful news. It's been wonderful news that he was arrested. He has been a fugitive for 30 years. He was the last big bosses to be a fugitive.
This is Professor of Criminology and Organized Crime expert Federico Varese.
It's an amazing achievement. It was not easy to arrest him. The net was closing on him. People close to him had been arrested only a few months earlier. So you could somewhat imagine that this was coming, but it's a fantastic news. It's also symbolically very important because this man has been one of the most ruthless, violent, terrible killers in the history of the Sicilian mafia. Of course, he murdered the women and children. He is one of the killers of Falcone. So it's the end of an era.
The end of an era for Cosa Nostra, I hope, compared to how it was in the past. But other mafia networks in southern Italy like the Camorra and Ndrangheta are still strong, still powerful and very dangerous. So if we look at the scale just of all of the Italian mafias, I mean, it's difficult to estimate these things, as I know from the Tax Justice Network's work. And the fact that transparency and financial transparency isn't there in so many places. But I've been looking at the estimated turnover of mafia business in Italy. According to the Bank of Italy, it's worth 2% of Italian GDP. That's about 38 billion euros a year. That's 104 million euros a day of dirty money washing through the system. I mean, can you speak to the scale and, you know, how big this is? Because 2% doesn't sound like a lot, but it really is.
Yeah, 2% is a lot, and the Bank of Italy is very reliable. So there have been other numbers floating around, like 7%. That's, I think, too much. It's really important to see how this money, this figure is constructed. There is a lot of confusion over this, because obviously what the mafia does, it extorts or protects, depending on the point of view, businesses. So businesses pay a cut of their profit to the organization, mainly in Western Sicily, where the mafia is most rooted. And so we have to distinguish the business from the mafia income. So the business remains independent and makes money. But there is often a tendency to confuse the turnover of the business with the profit of the business, with the profit of the mafia. And so it's very, very hard to construct meaningful estimates. You can say that the Sicilian mafia is certainly in decline, partly because of this massive pressure from the police, and also because they have left the drug strain. So they are not anymore involved in drugs as they used to be. Now, you can estimate the number of crime families which are in Western Sicily, and some of them also in Eastern Sicily, and this is a number around 80. And the estimate of the membership is between 1,000 and 400 made members. So you can work out from that. But of course, not everybody makes all that much money. I mean, some are soldiers in the organization who are probably just scraping through, and some, of course, the bosses make much more. So it's very hard to put a number to that. Certainly the Bank of Italy is a reliable source. Another way to think about this is that there is an office, procurator's office in Palermo, which is responsible for managing properties that are confiscated by, from people who are connected to the mafia, not necessarily mafia members, but also people connected to the mafia. So again, you can argue that maybe these confiscations happen very easily, but they estimate to have confiscated a third of the value of the Sicilian economy. So it's a lot of money. That would include items confiscated from people who are connected to the mafia, but not necessarily in the mafia. So this also could be people who just pay protection money, which of course is illegal in Italy.
So you can see what a huge effect Cosa Nostra has had in Sicily all these years. As Professor Varese's work has shown, Cosa Nostra tends to stay relatively local, where they can maintain the tightest control with people they trust. But one of their favourite jurisdictions to launder money is in nearby Malta. Just one investigation not so long ago discovered people with links to Cosa Nostra were generating 14 million euros a month through illegal online gaming there. Some of that cash generated was being reinvested in legitimate businesses. But we'll get back to Malta in a minute. This is journalist Stefano Vergine.
What we know for sure is that over the last years, Italian authorities seized around 4 billion euros that allegedly belongs to Messina Denaro. It's money that Messina Denaro invested through a number of his affiliates in legal businesses like supermarkets, wind farms, tourism companies, and also a lot of works of art. These assets were all in Italy, mainly in Sicily. The investments, of course, were not done by him. They were done by people close to him. But of course, this might not be the whole wealth belonging to Messina Denaro. So where could be the rest of his money? And for sure, we know that the global financial system provides a number of tools that help criminal organizations invest money. I'm thinking especially about tax havens and countries that guarantee the anonymity to beneficial owners of companies and of bank account holders. I'm thinking about Switzerland, for example, which borders Italy. Until a few years ago, bank secrecy was completely in place in Switzerland. And that means that if an Italian, for example, went to a Swiss bank with a bag full of cash, this person could deposit the money and no one would ever know this in Italy, neither judicial authorities. Now things have partially changed and Switzerland started to exchange data of account holders with the authorities of countries that are part of the OECD. Still, hiding money, however, is possible, and there are many places in the world that allow this to happen, officially or unofficially. One way is, for example, by using offshore companies linked to bank accounts that are based in a country where authorities don't actually check properly who their client is. Let me mention some examples that I found out in my job. In 2016, on the magazine L'Espresso, along with a group of colleagues, part of ICIJ, we work on the Panama Papers, and we found out the names of dozens of offshore companies managed by a number of trusted men of mafia leaders. I'm talking about people like the Graviano brothers, Salvatore Riina, Bernardo Provenzano, who have been the absolute leaders of the Sicilian mafia, the so-called Cosa Nostra. They were all sentenced to life imprisonment. In one case, for example, we revealed offshore companies doing business in Africa with gold and diamond mines. These companies, based mostly in the British Virgin Islands, were owned by the sons of Vito Palazzolo. We're talking about mafia organizations that are based on familiar ties. It's their strength. So Palazzolo was sentenced for being one of the biggest money launderers of Cosa Nostra when the mafia organization was led by Totò Riina. We're talking about the 90s. And its main business was trafficking heroin, around the world. Palazzolo was sentenced for mafia back in the 80s, but the public didn't know about these offshore companies owned by his sons until we revealed them in 2016. And this means that in the British Virgin Islands, no one raised a red flag on these companies, although the shareholders were sons of one of the biggest money launderers of Cosa Nostra. There are a number of cases like this. And in the Malta files, we also find cases like this. And this show that you don't necessarily have to go that far. You don't have to go to the Caribbean. You can stay close to Italy and go to Malta. In 2017, we revealed that some mafia organizations opened companies in the island. I'm talking about Sicilian Mafia, Camorra, and 'Ndrangheta, the Calabrian Mafia. For example, we found a company based in Malta whose director was the heir of an important mafia clan based in Calabria, the so-called 'Ndrangheta. The family is a big family specialized in cocaine trafficking with the South American cartels. So this is another example that shows how easy it can be for a criminal organization to open a company. Why is that? Even in countries where beneficial owners are not secret and where authorities officially collaborate with other countries, this is the case of Malta, for example, many banks and financial authorities don't really care about who their customers are as long as they bring money in. This is, I think, what actually helps criminal organizations to invest money overseas.
And sometimes the best investigations that have given us the most information were only because this information was leaked, right? And not because it's actually possible for somebody like you, sometimes a journalist, to actually get behind that wall of secrecy, to be able to report on who's behind a particular crime or a company involved in a crime, right?
That's true. I mean, most of the times, yes, the best investigations are coming from a leak or let's say from an internal source. It doesn't have to be a huge leak like Panama Papers, which was a very good investigation and brought a lot of results. But still, yes, one way is to have a police source that is telling you things that have been already uncovered. The other way is to have an internal source or a whistleblower that can bring a lot of data or data concerning his company's specific field of activity.
Yeah, otherwise it's like coming up against a brick wall. Let's have a look at Malta as one of the favourite jurisdictions for Cosa Nostra money. The harm Malta's done to itself and its people because of its oversized financial sector and offshore secrecy services is obvious. It's not exaggerating to say it's become a criminal state. Dirty money has undone the rule of law there, almost every check and balance. But it doesn't stop there, because once dirty money's gone into their financial system, it washes into the global economy too. This is Kevin Kassar. He's a surgeon in Malta who's spoken out about how Malta's become a mafia paradise.
Malta is just 60 miles south of Sicily. We can actually see Mount Etna on a clear day. So we are extremely close. We have regular ferries going across, which takes about just 2 hours by ferry. If you take a plane, it takes you 20 minutes to get to Sicily. The big advantage to mafiosi and other people in organized crime in Sicily is that Malta joined the European Union. And we're also, of course, we've got the euro, and we're part of Schengen, so there is free movement. So it's extremely easy to get in and out of Malta and into Europe and from Sicily into Malta with very little or no checks at all. In addition to that, Malta is the tiniest country in the European Union, which means that some of these criminal organizations have a turnover every year, which is basically the size of our economy. And therefore, in a small place like this, it is extremely easy to pay your way into whatever position you want to get to.
dirty money is also what led to the murder of Maltese journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia to shut down her investigations and the mess the police made of that case and allegations about politicians connected to it tell you everything about the state of justice in Malta. And just as telling, not long ago in Malta, the post of Deputy Police Commissioner became vacant. No one applied for it. And for me, that speaks very strongly about what kind of a failed state Malta actually is.
Yeah, it definitely is a failed state. And the problem is that the Prime Minister has almost absolute powers. So the Prime Minister appoints a police commissioner. The problem with that is that people who were deeply involved in gross corruption, who were involved in illegalities, who were close to the Prime Minister, were never prosecuted. So we have, for example, magisterial inquiries related to Pilatus Bank, for example, which specifically said that the chairman of Pilatus Bank, which is this money laundering enterprise for the Azerbaijanis and for people close to former Prime Minister Joseph Muscat, should be prosecuted. This man has never been prosecuted. We had another magisterial inquiry which looked into allegations that one of these secret financial structures set up by Mossack Fonseca belongs to the Prime Minister's wife, former Prime Minister Joseph Muscat, that is. And one of the accountants involved, who was part of the same company that was working very closely with the Prime Minister, the conclusions of the inquiry was that this man should be prosecuted for perjury. This man was never prosecuted. So we have a state of impunity, which was one of the main conclusions of the Daphne Caruana Galizia inquiry. So in answer to your question, why do people not want to join the police force in any, even almost at the lowest levels, let alone at the higher echelons? And the reason is that this is a completely corrupt institution. The police commissioner himself was finally removed when there was an order by the court that he should be investigated. That was months, if not years ago. No action has been taken against the former police commissioner. There's also huge pressure, of course, on people who are in the police force who try to do their job. So we've had people, for example, like a chap who was investigating these people close to politicians and politicians themselves, was basically hounded out of the force, and he's now suing the government for discrimination and for basically not reintegrating him into the police force. We had another gentleman who was in the FIAU, that's the Financial Investigative Authority, who was basically kicked out when he started to work on these cases of corruption involving politicians. So it's no surprise that nobody wants to get into a police force like that.
No surprise at all.
We live in a country where we've had several bombings, people killed with car bombs, the same type of bombs that killed Borsellino and Falcone. In a small country like this, where you have bombs exploding and killing people, none of those bombings has been solved. The only one that has partially been solved is the Caruana Galizia bombing, and that's because of the involvement of the FBI. So can you imagine a small country like ours, where we have multiple people killed from car bombings, and nobody ever arraigned? And I tell you possibly why. Because the people who are now under arrest, finally, the Maksar brothers, they were clients of our current Prime Minister. So our current Prime Minister was the lawyer defending the Maksar brothers. So this is the sort of network that we have, which is, to me, it is far worse than what is happening in Sicily. Because in Sicily, there is some rule of law. The state is trying to protect the citizens. In this country, our government, our authorities, our institutions, the police, are all part of this criminal network.
So, however bad things have been and can be in Sicily, Malta is a classic captured state because of its big financial secrecy sector. And looking the other way when it comes to criminal money coming in extends to everything. It undermines fair public procurement in the public interest, which Sicilians know all about too. All of this erodes people's trust in the state to provide for their needs. Kevin Casua, as a surgeon, has seen this for himself only too plainly in Malta.
We are really in dire straits because half of our health service was sold off to this company. They, of course, had absolutely no intention of improving the health service at all. And people in the health service, of course, can easily recognize a scam because you don't sell half the health service to somebody who's never run a clinic, let alone a hospital. Besides, later on, we found out that the government entered into a secret memorandum of understanding with this group of businessmen before the actually request for proposals by government was made. So they had already identified and decided who was going to run this enterprise. Of course, after 2 years and a lot of promises that they were going to build a new hospital, that they were going to revitalize an old hospital and develop more services, they promised that they would build another hospital in Gozo. They promised they would build a medical school in Gozo. They promised they would increase jobs. They promised they would increase beds. None of this happened. So from our point of view, what we've seen is when COVID struck and we needed more beds, we were deprived of those beds. Today, we are still lacking those beds, and we are ending up, for example, changing a staff canteen into a ward. We're still using a staff canteen for a ward. So the reality of the situation in practice is that giving out this concession, as it was called, to these people has basically seriously eroded the quality of care that we can offer our patients. And of course, we've lost millions. So these millions, nobody really knows where they've gone. The National Audit Office have published 3 separate reports. They're damning reports. They highlight that this was a scam from start to finish. There has been no action taken against any of the people involved. This is 4 billion euros. Can you imagine in a small country like ours?
Yeah, yeah. And I think my question to you then is, I think that none of the things that you're describing could happen without financial secrecy. That's been such a central part of the economy there in Malta, and that's having a really bad effect not just on people in Malta, but people in Sicily, people in Italy, people everywhere in the world, because it's all connected. So my question is, as you know, we campaign against financial secrecy. We want the real beneficial owners of companies to be declared publicly, that there should be public registries, that there's full financial transparency in all areas. So what effect would full financial transparency on a place like Malta be, do you think?
I think this is absolutely crucial. So half our public health service was sold to a company, and no single Maltese person actually knew the ultimate beneficial owner of the company behind this. It was so opaque, the structures upon structures were impossible. So we were being told as citizens that half our health service was being sold to somebody, and we didn't even know who this somebody was. So, you know, that is one big problem. But the truth is that leading our government, which is really a party that still has a massive support base in this country, are people who have been working tirelessly to make financial structures even more opaque. We've recently had the Minister of the Economy, who's made it even more difficult for citizens to identify who is the ultimate beneficial owner of companies which are registered in this country. You can't know who they are. There's been about 10,000 companies that have been suddenly scrubbed off the Malta Business Registry. So we can't go back historically once we find out that these companies were involved in illicit activity and find out who they were. So it is extremely difficult for journalists to do their job. It's almost impossible to get clear answers. This is a mafia state. This is a state captured by a small group of people who are making millions, who are becoming obscenely wealthy, and who are draining the funds of this country for their own personal gain. And that's not something I am saying. It's something that the U.S. State Department has said. And this is why a former minister of energy and the chief of staff of the former prime minister can't get into the United States as we speak.
Journalist Stefano Vergine again.
I think the main problem is
the system, financial system, that allows these kind of things. Because, for example, if you have foreign companies investing in Italy, but you are not able to find out who the beneficial owners are, well, that's an issue. And you can't do much from an Italian point of view. So I think this is the biggest problem.
And again, the problem isn't contained in one part of the world. The weak links in each jurisdiction interconnect, and they're easy to exploit. Professor Varese again.
I think it's obvious that you need to know who is the ultimate beneficiary of shell companies or trusts. And I think the kind of the regulations we see in London, in which you can own a company which is owned by another company, and you can easily create a company with fake names, or you have these addresses in London which have thousands and thousands of companies in one address. I think all of that is facilitating massive criminal money transfers. So I think is crazy.
And this is also where it gets politically tricky. No jurisdiction has clean hands, and they're all slow to cast stones because they're all living in glass houses. But Malta has become such a threat to the EU for various reasons. The EU Commission's been monitoring events there. It's done a number of reports on what's going wrong. So, Kevin, what should the European Parliament, the Commission, be doing to help tackle corruption in Malta, do you think?
A lot of people looked towards the European Union to act as, if you like, a protector for the people from its own government. Sadly, a lot of people here feel very let down by the European Union. The European Union has been very weak. The reality is that if Europe wanted to control this country, they could by withholding funds. There are hundreds of millions coming from Europe. So the first thing that Europe should do is that not simply write reports, but it must impose clear requirements. It should immediately withhold funds until all the measures have been taken to implement proper rule of law, to implement proper checks and balances, and to ensure that none of the money that's coming from Europe is diverted into criminal organizations, criminal activity, and rampant corruption. But of course, Europe won't do that because it will appear to be picking on a small state when it has much bigger problems such as, you know, Hungary and Poland. But the truth is that, as was done with the case of Hungary, changes will only come if there is severe imposition and restriction of funds to this country.
The EU should take action. The trouble is the EU does things like maintain a ridiculous black and grey list system of jurisdictions it says are non-cooperative for tax purposes, and they need to improve governance in those areas. So with these lists, it doesn't list any EU nations, no matter what they do. So it needs really to face up to its own failings. Professor Varese again.
The social and political cost of the existence of the mafia is massive, that's for sure. I mean, there is more than just the economic value, right? I mean, the economic value is important, but they interfere in the political process. They interfere in the economic development of the island. And of course, they generate fear and violence, although not necessarily a lot of murders. The fear that they generate is massive. And also they generate a distrust, you know, in the Italian state and among people themselves. As for the Sicilian mafia, it's fair to say that the Sicilian mafia, and even the arrest of Matteo Messina Denaro, is not going to disappear because of the arrest of one person. And yes, it is under huge police pressure, but unfortunately, the mafia is still there, and now all the bosses are in jail and new bosses will come up. So there's really a question for Italy to ask what really we need to do to defeat once and for all the Sicilian mafia. And that is to regain the trust of the people in Sicily, who distrust greatly the Italian state. And tax evasion is not just a feature of the mafia, it's a feature of Italy in general. So I think the Italian state has to, and the Italian political class, has to ask big questions of why the mafia is still not being eliminated. The mafia is not just a criminal phenomenon linked to money laundering. It's a political, social, and economic phenomenon which is deeply rooted in the lack of trust in an Italian state which is extremely inefficient. Only yesterday I read about a case in a civil court that took 20 years to be settled. 20 years. Imagine if you are a business. And so that generated demand for the mafia. And so business people turned to the mafia to settle disputes, even legal disputes. And then, of course, the mafia gets a foothold in the legal economy. They are paid for these services, and then they launder them in the local economy. And so that, is, to me, is the root cause of the mafia, a deeply inefficient state and a state that is not trusted by the people. A lot of the job the mafia does is involved in construction. You know, they organize construction bids, and so making it more transparent, the way construction contracts are allocated is very important, and possibly to centralize more the bids as opposed to keep them local, because at the local level, the mafia is extremely powerful. So I think tackling the money the mafia makes is certainly important, and we need to do that. But in itself, it may not be enough.
No, definitely not. I've seen exactly what you're talking about in Sicily, where, you know, somebody has something stolen and they don't go to the police, they go to where they can receive a service. And I mean, I don't think anybody thinks that's the right way or it's the way they prefer, but it's the way that they use often, you know, not all people, but many people. And then it's so important that a tax system must be accountable, and it's part of building trust with people. So how do you use a tax system to build trust, which is understandably gone in a place where, to differing extents in Sicily, the state is really not in evidence, it's not really present in people's lives?
Yeah, a simple, straightforward and fair tax system is crucial. And in the Italian case, you have a lot of exceptions, a lot of people, a lot of subgroups that don't pay taxes. And so that generates a sense of unfairness and privilege that there are. There are small groups of well-connected and well-organized groups in society and in the economy who can avoid paying taxes. So there is the overwhelming burden of taxes is paid in Italy by people who are employed by the state, like teachers or professors or nurses. And so it gives you the impression that there is a section of society that overwhelmingly pays taxes and cannot avoid paying them, and a section of society which doesn't pay taxes. So I totally agree. I think that is one of the key elements to making the state more efficient, together with, of course, the justice system, especially the civil court system. Ultimately, you need a functioning state, a state that functions and also is not too complicated. So transparency, efficiency, and justice carried out quickly is crucial to regain trust in the state. So to me, this is absolutely crucial if we want to tackle the deep-rooted reasons. So ultimately, we need the state reform in all its parts so that you have an efficient provision of goods and services, including welfare state, which is obviously not working very well. Imagine that in Sicily, roads are like not really working across the island, and they often break down, so you cannot cross the island sometimes because there is an accident in the highway.
Oh yeah, definitely. Near my town in Sicily, there was a road that was closed off for years and years, and we all had to go on a crazy long diversion because they didn't fix it for so long. Sometimes Sicilians themselves just get together and fix their own roads. I mean, staff who work in care homes looking after the elderly go on strike sometimes because they haven't been paid for months. The local rubbish collection that people pay taxes for just stops. Once it happened for months, people were burning the rubbish to keep the rats and the stray dogs away. Then they introduced another local ring-fenced rubbish tax. I mean, imagine how people feel when that stops working. I mean, people will believe and go for anything that seems to work in their lives.
Yes, I don't think it's a matter necessarily of increasing expenditures. I think it's a matter of spending better what we already spend and really restructuring the state. But it really requires the fight against entrenched special interests. So it's costly politically, but the problem with the Syrian mafia would never be solved by purely arresting people and military and police forces, though they are extremely important, of course, because these people have to be arrested, like Messina Denaro, and they have been found guilty in court. So obviously that has to be done. And I would say investigations are actually quite efficient and quite thorough, but everything else is not. And until everything else is tackled and becomes a genuine national emergency for the first time, really, then I think the problem of the mafia will stay with us. And then, yes, they will launder their money, they will interfere with politics, they will interfere with the local economy, they will generate fear and further distrust in the state.
So much of this comes down to the failure to establish a social and economic model based on fundamental rights. Central to that is a transparent, fair and accountable tax and financial system. Without a system like that, a predatory one will form that generates injustices, inequalities and democratic inadequacies where criminal opportunities for profit and power flourish and spread. The Matteo Messina Denaros of this world can't enjoy the levels of wealth they do without these weak links of secrecy in our global financial system. As I say, some of those weak links also serve commerce and other rich and powerful people. That's why public registries of the real owners of companies, trusts and foundations are so important. Failure to properly collect, verify and publish this information should mean fines and prosecutions. After years of pressure from anti-corruption campaigners, the European Union did finally take action to introduce a requirement for European countries to implement public registers of the beneficial ownership information of companies. But a recent ruling from the European Court of Justice has reversed 10 years of progress. As a result, many leading European tax havens have once more restricted access. The winners from all this are the Matteo Messina Denaros of this world and their professional enablers, unscrupulous lawyers, accountants, wealth managers and bankers. That's it for this edition of the TaxCast. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you next month.
Every rat bastard capitalist should have his books exposed. We need to know what these bastards are making. Look at the goddamn price of eggs. Goddamn simple fucking eggs. Unbelievable. And you let them do it to us. Unbelievable.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County, Kansas, your one true voice in Kansas. This is the Radio Free Kansas.
Log Talk Radio.
Kansas.
Let's talk about
Radio Free Kansas out of North Jefferson County, Kansas.
Common side effects include heart failure, persistent fever, bruising, bleeding, lymphoma, nervous system, and blood disorders.
The message is now part of and registered in your subconscious mind. Every time you say, see, hear, or think,
Radio Free Kansas.
That's your key phrase. It will trigger the entire message without you being aware of it.
Oh, man, that is just wrong.
If you wish to survive, you need to cultivate a strong mental attitude.
It's a fool who looks for logic in the chambers of the human heart.